Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. We welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And there is a website for the program, which you can find at radioinvivo.net. You can access all of our past programs on that website. And after a year and a half of doing the show, it's now quite an extensive archive on the wide variety of topics we've featured here on the show. So we encourage you to check it out. And Radio In Vivo is also available as a podcast on iTunes. All you have to do is go to the iTunes site, search Radio In Vivo, and it will take you right to the podcast site. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well at communityradio.coop. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And it's a pleasure to finally be able to call it the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences. Had their official rededication of what formerly was CIIT just last week, something that's been long anticipated, and we certainly congratulate them that it's now all official. They are the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. And this week on Radio In Vivo, we are going to explore the fascinating world of bees and beekeeping, an absorbing subject at any time. But with the current crisis situation in the honeybee population, it's a topic that's been all over the front pages recently. Here to fill us in on what's going on with the bees is Dr. David Tarpey. David is an assistant professor in the Department of Entomology at North Carolina State University, and he is North Carolina's extension apiculturist, or honeybee specialist. He is also director of the North Carolina Master Beekeeper Program, the oldest continuous program of its kind in the country. David received his B.S. in biology from Hobart College, his M.S. in biology from Bucknell University, and his Ph.D. in entomology from the University of California at Davis. After postdocs at Cornell, he joined the faculty at North Carolina State in 2003. And we certainly want to alert everyone that David will be the guest of honor at a Science Cafe event at Tiernanog in Raleigh next Tuesday, June 19th, starting at 7 p.m. Science cafes are co-sponsored by the local chapter of Sigma Xi and the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. And they are events designed to give all of us the opportunity to meet informally with scientists and researchers, hear about their work, and to ask questions and engage in discussions. Kind of like what we do here on Radio En Vivo, but with beer. David, welcome to Radio En Vivo.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, and I appreciate the show.
Well, thanks. I certainly want to spend some time with you, David, later on, picking your brain about the fascinating science that goes on in studying honeybees. Mm-hmm. But, of course, we need to start with the headline today. Could you give us a quick rundown of the current situation in which we're apparently losing honeybees in massive numbers in the U.S.?
That's correct. There's been a recently documented phenomenon known as colony collapse disorder, a not-so-sexy name, but quite apt because we really don't know the cause behind why the honeybees are dying. In the past, say, 2-3 decades, honeybee colonies have been dying from all sorts of reasons, particularly introduced parasitic mites that have been very serious problems for honeybees and beekeepers. And so the fact that honeybees dying is not very unusual in the past few years. However, mm-hmm. the most recent phenomenon of these colony collapses, it's the manner in which they're dying that's very unusual, and it can't be chalked up to the usual suspects. And so that's really caused a lot of concern among apiculture officials, and they're trying to get to the bottom of it.
So do you think that this is a temporary, seasonal type of situation, or are we looking at a potentially permanent collapse here?
It's unclear at this point. Until we identify the causative agent or agents, it's going to be difficult to say that. I should note that there have been similar collapses periodically in history, dating back to 1898 is one of the first documented cases of colonies mysteriously disappearing mm-hmm. and just seemingly abandoning the hive. And there have been numerous cases of this throughout beekeeping history in the last 100 years or so.
Sure.
However, it's unclear if this is going to be a continued phenomenon or not.
I see. What about North Carolina? Has colony collapse disorder been affecting honeybee populations here? What have you been seeing out in the field?
Well, it's hard to say, as there's no very good data collection system in determining the honeybee population in North Carolina or in the nation, which mm-hmm. has been pretty surprising given the importance that honeybees play in our agricultural economy and in our food supply. But with that said, just anecdotally, there have been cases of colony collapse disorder in North Carolina. It doesn't seem to be isolated geographically within the state, and seems to be periodic throughout the state. But it doesn't seem, overall, just my gut sense seems to think that North Carolina doesn't seem to have been hit as hard as some of the larger states that have larger honeybee populations.
At least not yet.
At least from what we can tell, that's correct.
I see. Well, you mentioned that as of right now, the cause of colony collapse disorder is still unknown. As an expert, both as an expert beekeeper and an expert on the science, what do you think is going on? What's your gut telling you? Do you have any theories?
Well, it's such a complicated system that it really could be any number of things, could be one of hundreds of things. And so there's been a collaborative group of researchers formed from industry, government, and academic agencies coming together and all pooling our resources to try to get to the bottom of it, each of us adding our own particular expertise. And what this CCD working group has been doing is really concentrating on four main areas by which we're going to be investigating this particular problem. The first is to perform beekeeper surveys. Understanding where beekeepers are affected, their relationship to other beekeepers or other agriculture systems or environmental geographic distribution is very, very important. So getting information from the beekeepers is a top priority.
Sure.
A second thrust is going to be looking at the potential role of nutritional stress. That is, are these colonies collapsing because they're somehow nutritionally deficient in some way, that they're not being provided enough nectar or pollen, the foodstuffs that they subsist on? And so seeing if colonies that are somehow hungrier than others are more susceptible to collapsing from this phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
A third area, a very large area, an important one, is going to be looking at pathologies. So as we know, honeybees have a litany of different diseases, parasites, and pathogens that they're afflicted with. And so trying to determine if this particular collapse disorder is because of something new about an existing disease, or whether there's potentially a new pathogen or parasite out there that we don't know about that may be causing this. And so looking at pathology is very, very important then with this. And then finally, the fourth area of major interest is going to be looking at environmental contaminants. As you know, honeybees are interacting very heavily with the environment, both in and out of agricultural systems. And so they can pick up many different chemicals from the environment, pesticides or otherwise, and looking at the potential role that that may play in this colony collapse.
I see. Well, I want to go into a little bit more detail in some of those areas you just mentioned. But this CCD working group, is that a nationally organized effort at this point?
It's a loose affiliation, okay. More than some strict mandated group. Mm-hmm. It's just a collection of apiculture researchers that, rather than compete to try and find the answer, we've all collected together and trying to unify our efforts and collectively come to the answer.
I see. So it's almost like an epidemiological research effort.
It very much is. It's very much some sleuthing going on right now.
Mm-hmm. David, why has the migratory honeybee business become so large and so significant? And could you describe that part of it for us?
Sure, Ernie. What you're describing, the migratory beekeepers are usually large-scale beekeepers, so they have hundreds, if not thousands, of beehives, and they do not have a permanent location, ergo migratory. They load their hives onto flatbed trucks, and they transport them from one site to another. In many of the larger cases, many of the larger beekeepers go up and down the eastern seaboard, go out west to California to pollinate crops out there. And so they unload the bees at various sites with growers that they've contracted with, put the bees into the orchards or the crops during the bloom, so the bees can then visit the various flowers and cross-pollinate them, and therefore the plants themselves will produce the fruit that is being grown. So without the bees, you wouldn't get that cross-pollination, and therefore you wouldn't get the crop itself. And so honeybees are very, very important. The migratory beekeepers are a fundamental component of that. And it's been estimated that honeybees account for about $20 billion of added agricultural produce every year, which accounts for about a third of everything we eat.
Wow. And what types of crops is this practice used on?
There's about 100 or so crops that rely almost entirely or in large part on honeybees for crop pollination. Just to give it a local spin, the top five crops in North Carolina are cucumbers, apples, blueberries, melons, and squash.
Mm-hmm.
But others include strawberries, peaches, watermelons, pumpkins. I could go on and on.
I understand they're critical in almonds.
They're incredibly critical in almonds. Of course, the almond industry is primarily located in northern California.
Mm-hmm.
But the $2 billion-plus a year almond industry is entirely dependent on honeybees. No other insect can really pollinate almonds, and pollination is absolutely required for almond set. So about half of all the honeybee hives in North America, or in the United States. So about 1.25 to 1.5 million hives migrate to Northern California every January and February for almond pollination.
So unless you're in the business, it's probably a good place to stay away from at that time of year.
Correct.
Well, I think people, you know, generally speaking, are probably not aware, at least until recently, you know, with all the publicity about colony collapse disorder, of this large business and its critical role in generating our food supply.
Absolutely. The conventional wisdom seems to hold that beekeepers are strictly hobby beekeepers. They have a hive or two out in their backyard, and they just do so they can raid the honey once a year rather than buy it off of the supermarket shelves. And that while most of the beekeepers out there are indeed hobbyists, even hobbies beekeepers play a very significant role in our honey supply, but more importantly, in pollination of agriculture as well as the environment or our backyards.
So these migratory beekeepers, I understand that is a very stressful practice for the bees, that they're being moved around so frequently and often in great distances and things like that.
Absolutely. Obviously, moving your entire house all at once, you can just imagine yourself being put into that situation. Yes, it would be very stressful. The bees are very readily able to adapt to a new environment, so they're placed. They're often moved overnight so that all the bees are at home mm-hmm. when the hive is actually physically moved. And so when they wake up the next morning, they come on out. They relocate to the different blossoms and blooms in their new environment, and they're able to handle that very well. But in agricultural settings, unfortunately, while the plants are very reliant on the bees for cross-pollination, some of the crops out there, certainly not all, but some of the crops do not provide sufficient nutrition for the bees. So even though the bees are visiting these flowers, they're actually not gaining as much nutrients as they otherwise might mm-hmm. If they were not in that kind of monoculture setting. So beekeepers often need to supplement food for the bees in order to keep them healthy and strong.
I see. And is that the kind of thing that's well documented as to maybe which crops do not provide that sufficient?
Certainly. I'll just give you an example. Cucumbers, for example, they're a fairly decent pollen source for the bees, but the blossoms hardly produce any nectar. And so while the bees are in the cucumber fields for, say, 2 weeks, they can lose up to 30 pounds of honey just because they have to tap into their surplus honey stores. Conversely, blueberries are also incredibly important and reliant on honeybees, but they make a terrific, those flowers make a lot of nectar, and the beekeeper can make a pretty good honey crop off of blueberries while they're in the orchards.
I see. The stress you were talking about of all of that movement, and I understand that these migratory beekeepers have to replace their stocks pretty frequently. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is there any thought that some of that may be contributing to colony collapse disorder?
That's going to be certainly looked at as to the role of stress overall, stressors overall, but nutritional stress in particular, and what are kind of the biological limits of the bees. I mean, these migratory beekeepers have been doing this for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But the environment is constantly changing, and so that interaction then is very important to understand. And there's some studies going on right now to try and look at that and try and look at, okay, well, how many moves is optimal for a particular honeybee colony for them to stay healthy, and how many is too many. So there's some investigation into that right now.
I see. You also mentioned that one of the areas the working group is going to be looking into is environmental contaminants, mm-hmm. and I want to ask you specifically about that.
Sure.
About the role of, you know, pesticides and other agricultural chemicals. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure that measures are taken to minimize these exposures by the honeybees. That would seem obvious. But as we are seeing more and more in humans, even low-level exposures mm-hmm, or mm-hmm. chronic low-level exposures to some mm-hmm. of these chemicals can have pretty dramatic adverse effects.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Could these types of exposures be inhibiting the bees' innate navigational systems?
It's certainly plausible, and in fact, that's one of the top hypotheses that's being tested. There have been some studies done on honeybees and certain insecticides that at normal doses are outright lethal to honeybees, but at sublethal doses, there may be some unpredicted effects. For example, there are certain neurotoxins that may interfere with honeybees' ability to learn, particularly in flight. So as the bees fly from the hive, they can't find their way back. And right. so that's
and
been...
And that's at the heart of colony collapse disorder,
and that's,
is it not?
It seems to fit with the symptomology that the bees in the hive just all of a sudden disappear. And
right.
it's certainly logically plausible that something like a learning disability on behalf of the bees may be responsible for that. So
maybe we just need to give them all Ritalin and they'll be fine.
Well, that might work. But the one of the top priorities then, because of that and knowing that, has been to look at environmental contaminants that can be picked up in the comb. So as you know, a honeybee colony has 50, 60,000 adult bees. And the substrate of the nest itself is built of the hexagonal wax comb that the bees synthesize and actually build the nest.
Mm-hmm.
That wax comb is used not only as a food pantry for the honey and pollen that they collect and store, but also as individual nurseries for developing baby bees or the brood.
Uh-huh.
And so the wax itself is very chemically complex, and it absorbs many lipophilic compounds from the environment, and so it collects all sorts of things that the bees are interacting with in the environment like a sponge. And so part of the efforts of the CCD working group has been to go to different yards where some colonies have been collapsing and others have not
mm-hmm.
in the same location, and taking samples of not only adult bees, if there are any left, but also the sections of the wax comb. And those sections of wax comb then are being subjected to chemical analyses through GC mass spec analyses to look at the myriad chemicals that not only are in the comb naturally, but may be picking up from the external environment. If there are certain chemicals, particularly known pesticides or other environmental contaminants that are found in the CCD-affected colonies and not in the non-affected colonies, then that will give a very strong clue as to a potential cause.
Sure. So you're basically conducting case control studies, and like you say, if you find something that is a clear differentiation between the two, you may have a smoking gun.
Correct. It would be correlative, not causative, of course, at that point, but
sure.
It certainly would be a big find and a big lead. It's a very complicated system. This is outside of my area of expertise, the chemistry behind it, but
mm-hmm.
Looking at the known pesticides and other contaminants and their derivatives is easier said than done, but there's a lot of really good people working very hard on this right now.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to just make sure that we covered, David, is that one thing that differentiates this particular crisis situation, the phenomenon itself, is that unlike pathogenic problems that have been seen in the past in the 80s and 90s, I know, were sometimes
mm-hmm.
quite severe,
mm-hmm.
You're not coming to the hive and finding hundreds, if not thousands, of dead bees. They are just simply disappearing.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Maybe I should have explained this before, kind of the symptoms of this colony collapse disorder. And the biggest one, as you pointed out, is that they have disappeared. In traditional pathogen situations. There are often dead bees or cadavers lying on the bottom board of the hive or out front in front of the hive. In really unfortunate events of, say, beehives are located next to a field where there was insecticide sprayed and they didn't realize the bees were there, and often you just see the entire colony population, you know, dead in front of the hive. It's a very unfortunate sight. Mm-hmm. But for this colony collapse disorder, it's just a complete absence of all bees. And so they just seem to have disappeared or have left. If there are any bees remaining, it's only about a fistful of bees, only about a softball-sized cluster of bees, which is far fewer than what actually would normally inhabit a full-sized colony, mm-hmm. and the queen. So it doesn't appear as if the bees just, for example, decided to move house, because the queen would clearly be leaving with them. So the fact that there are a few bees, and only those bees that cannot fly seem to be the ones that remain, is very abnormal and does not indicate anything that we know of as far as classic pesticide poisoning or some known pathogen. Another interesting observation of this particular phenomenon is that an abandoned hive full of honey and all this other resources, wax and all of this other good stuff, is often immediately robbed out by other neighboring bees. Or hive pests, such as wax moths, which are a natural hive pest of not the bees themselves, but they eat the wax and the pollen that's in the nest itself, or a relatively new scourge known as the small hive beetle, which also eats the nest substrate. These pests and the robber bees don't seem to be moving into these abandoned hives.
As normally they would.
Okay. There seems to be this 3, 4, 5 week period where they won't touch this abandoned resource that's mm-hmm. that's wide open to them, but they only move in after a certain period of time. So that's a very, very unusual symptom.
And that sure does point to exactly what you were talking about, that there is some kind of chemical contamination going on.
Very possibly, but it doesn't necessarily mean some sort of environmental contaminant, because it still could be pathological in origin, because there are many fungi, for example, that produce aflatoxins or other chemicals that are toxic to other biologicals. And so, but what it does indicate is that there is something different and something very unusual in the manner in which these bees are dying. I also would like to point out that bees dying over the winter, in particular, is, as I pointed out earlier, not very unusual. And this year, there seems to be a population loss, greater population loss over the entire U.S. of 20 to 30%, which has not been the worst year in recent years. Mm-hmm. For example, in 2004, it was estimated that about 50% of the beehives died that particular year. So the number of losses this year is not the worst case scenario, at least in recent history. And of those losses, it's been estimated that only about 25% or so can be attributed to this CCD, mm-hmm. which means that the other 75% are because of the usual suspects, these parasitic mites that beekeepers have been dealing with for decades. And so what's really concerning about this CCD is not the magnitude of it necessarily, it's that it's completely unknown and that we don't know what's causing it.
I see. Well, David, I wanted to ask you about a report I came across recently in preparing to speak with you today that claimed that organic bees are actually thriving, quite the opposite of what's going on with these large-scale commercially managed bee colonies. What do you make of that?
Well, organic beekeeping, as in all organic agriculture, has very strict definitions and limitations on what you can use. Standard beekeeping, a lot of beekeepers use in-hive pesticides to control these varroa mites and these other parasitic mites. Mm-hmm. Organic beekeepers choose to use other technologies, mostly non-chemical technologies, in order to control those mites, because Without some sort of beekeeper intervention, the bees will usually succumb to these mites because they are not, they're exotic pests. They do not have any natural defenses to them. And so within a year or two, colonies will usually die off from these pests. So organic beekeepers use certain mechanical technologies or different means of controlling the pest populations of particularly of these mites. And the reports that the CCD has not been showing up in any organic beekeeping operations is interesting, and it's certainly worth noting. However, again, because we don't have a clear enough data collection of all the beekeepers, it's pretty hard to find any trends in that. But again, it does speak to that management practices as well as location, because organic beekeepers can only be certified if the forage area around the hive is also certified organic.
I see.
And that's a 2-mile radius, which is a very, very large area.
It is, absolutely.
Indeed. And so it suggests that there is some sort of beekeeper management and environment interaction that may be responsible for this.
And is that something also, is that another line of research that the working group is looking into also?
In the context of the environmental contaminants and the pathologies, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. David Tarpey. And David is an assistant professor in the Department of Entomology at North Carolina State University. And he is an extension apiculturist or honeybee specialist. And he is also director of the North Carolina Master Beekeeper Program. David, exactly what are the larger implications of this particular crisis in the honeybee population? Is this as dire as the news reports would have us believe, or has this been sensationalized, as was the case, I think, with the killer bees several years ago?
Well, that's hard to say. It's hard to make that prediction. If there were no honeybees, then we would not have a lot of agricultural produce, and what would be there would probably be more expensive. So, in that sense, it can be very serious.
And we're already seeing some rise in food prices as a result of this.
I think it's hard to make that connection, but I think a line can be drawn there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's certainly not a time to panic. And as I pointed out, the magnitude of this particular disorder is not as great as the ones that beekeepers have been dealing with for decades.
Sure.
And so, you know, beekeepers have been able to they've been very good at overcoming a lot of adversity.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this new phenomenon, we just hope that it's not just one more thing that all the beekeepers are going to have to deal with, or if they do, that it's going to be a relatively small problem compared to others.
I see.
But with that said, not knowing the cause of it, it's very scary, because it could very easily be something that that would dwarf the previous problems.
I see. So it's something that certainly needs this immediate attention that it's getting, but it is not, you know, we're not losing the honeybees as some of these news reports would have had us believe.
Yeah, I think that and this was pointed out to me once, that if every year, you know, we're losing 30-50% of our bees, pretty soon we're not going to have any left. And so, you know, every spring when we said, oh, we lost, you know, 30% of the bees this year, this is a serious problem for agriculture, while true, what you have to keep in mind, that beekeepers are very well adept at making up those numbers. What they do is they take one strong hive and they split it in half, and now they have two hives.
Mm-hmm.
So every year there's a constant, you know, building up the population back to the numbers that they need.
And that's part of the business of being a beekeeper.
Absolutely. And that's part of the business. Catching swarms, for example, is another way to increase the number of hives.
That sounds like fun.
Absolutely. It's it's terrific fun if you've ever done it, and if you haven't, I certainly encourage you to do so.
Oh, I'll give it a try.
But so increasing the numbers, the honeybee population is really, really important for the beekeepers. The problem, of course, comes that they can only do so for so long. They constantly losing beehives and constantly having to replace them. There's going to come a point where they're not going to be able to increase, you know, make up the increases for the losses, particularly with these various problems kind of compounding themselves.
I see. Well, returning to the CCD situation, David, as you've described, obviously beekeeping has become a big business, and actually has been for a long time. But with the advent of the kinds of intensive management and manipulation of populations, you know, we hear about things like artificial insemination and genetic manipulations. Is there any chance that these types of practices could actually be contributing to the problem in some way?
Well, the artificial insemination of the honeybee queens is more of a genetic tool that researchers use to understand the genetic underpinnings of honeybees, their behavior, and the colony phenotype. Mm-hmm. It's not really done commercially at a large scale.
I see.
So that's not that's very unlikely that's the case.
Okay.
And while there has been there have been some studies showing that genetically modifying bees and introducing foreign DNA to bees is technically possible. It has not been implemented in any way to the honeybee breeding stocks.
So we aren't looking at GMO bees.
We're not looking at GMO bees. While I would suppose the technology is there, there really isn't anybody, at least to my knowledge, that's working on that. Rather, a lot of the selection programs that have been implemented to try to better improve the honeybee stock and their characteristics to fend off diseases and parasites have just been classic breeding programs, just like in any other situation.
I see. Well, one other scenario I've heard about that I must ask you about is the possibility that some type of electromagnetic radiation, potentially cell phone radiation, has been mentioned, could be interfering with the bees' navigational abilities. Do you lend any credence to that?
Well, as the CCD working group's motto is that you know, nothing is ruled out at this point, but some possibilities are lower on the priority list.
Right.
That cell phone story certainly made a lot of headlines very, very quickly, but that's one of those hypotheses that's very low on the list, and the reasons are numerous. One is that honeybees don't use magnetism to navigate. Unlike, you know, carrier pigeons or in a lot of other biological systems, they don't use the magnetic poles to orient.
I see.
Rather, they use the sun as a compass. So they, and their classic dance language that that they use in order to recruit bees, new novice bees to new resources, is all based on the sun as a compass. And the sun moves over the course of the day, so they change their orientation based on the current position of the sun. And so it's a really fascinating system, but it doesn't use electromagnetism in any way. So in that sense, electromagnetic flux really is not going to impair their ability to find their way around.
Mm-hmm.
That said, they do use electromagnetism, in particular gravity, in building their wax comb. So they build these parallel wax combs in a very orderly manner to maximize the use of the cavity of the nest that they're in. And so by putting a huge, you know, electromagnet on top of a hive and let them build their comb, it will disrupt their ability to build nice parallel structured combs. But it would take a really huge electromagnetic field in order to accomplish that. Mm-hmm. So even bees that hives that are placed underneath, for example, large power lines that have these electromagnetic flux, they're still not really impaired by that. In any way.
So that does seem like an unlikely possibility.
Yeah, the last anecdotal evidence about the cell phones in particular is that just looking at the location of beekeepers that have experienced colony collapse disorder and, say, radio towers or the cell phone towers, some completely unaffected bee colonies are right beneath a cell phone tower. Other colonies that have been affected are out in the middle of Montana where they can't even get cell phone reception. So there doesn't seem to be that kind of geographic linkage that makes that a high priority for research.
I see. My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning is Dr. David Tarpey from North Carolina State. David Turner, I think we've covered colony collapse disorder pretty thoroughly, unless there's anything you wanted to add.
No, I think so.
I'm sure our listeners would love to hear more about you and your work. First of all, how did you get into this line of expertise and research? Were you one of those kids who was always into bugs?
I was to a certain extent, but not to a great extent. I got into honeybees because of my fascination with animal behavior and behavioral ecology. So I've always been fascinated by, watching flocks of birds fly, or watching a bumblebee pollinate a stand of flowers, or how squirrels interact in the spring versus in the fall. I've always been very interested in that. And upon learning about honeybees as a model system for social insects, it really drew me in, because I'm fascinated by how tens of thousands of individuals collectively work to serve the function of the colony itself. And so there seems to be a very super organism aspect to social insects, and honeybees have been a model system of that superorganism concept. And so understanding how the...
Which we call a hive mentality, right?
Quite correctly. And how they collectively function, and how natural selection acts on the colony rather than at the individual, that's really fascinated me.
I see. What type of research have you done in this area?
Well, our research tends to specialize on various aspects of honeybee queen biology. As you probably know, and your listeners probably know, there's 50,000 bees within a colony, but most of them are daughter workers of a single mother queen. And so that queen is just an egg-laying machine. She doesn't do any of the work in the hive.
I read somewhere that the queen is actually the worst job in the world.
Well, yeah, it's a pretty boring life, laying 1,800 eggs a day, which to us, there's no context for that, but that's about twice her own body weight in eggs a day. And that's all she does day in, day out. So, but genetically, she is clearly, the most important individual in the colony. And so understanding her role in the colony phenotype, this kind of extended phenotype of the colony is very interesting to me. And so part of our research has focused on two main areas of honeybee queen biology, certainly not the vast majority of her life where she's just laying eggs, but the exciting time in her life, which is very early on, which is when she grows and develops. A colony will raise queens, and they will raise about 1 to 2 dozen new queens when they want to replace their old queen. And of those 1 to 2 dozen queens, only one can survive and take over the nest.
Sure.
So they actually physically battle each other until there's one victor. The rest of them all perish in these lethal duels. And so we look at the possibility of collective decision-making during these queen duels. In other words, they have 12 potential queens, only one survive. Which one of those survives and why? You know, is there a potential selection of the workers favoring one over others?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at the possible role that workers may play. And there seems to be biases that the workers can instill in this process and therefore may be some collective decision-making over which queen becomes the new heiress to the throne.
So the crowd has a potential influence in the outcome of the gladiator battles that are going on.
Yeah, that's what it seems. It's very subtle. Behavioral interactions. The workers don't actually physically kill the queens that they quote-unquote don't want,
mm-hmm.
But they may be influencing these fights in some way to provide one more an advantage over others. And so there's a very interesting interplay there because, of course, it doesn't matter for the queen, each queen, she definitely wants to take over the nest. So there's kind of this conflict of interest then between the workers and the superorganism and the individual queen in their choice of who's going to win.
Wow.
The other area of research that we've been concentrating on is after that decision has been made and the queen takes over the nest, she then goes on mating flights, where she will mate with numerous males, an average of about 12 or so males, away from the hive, not inside the hive. They fly from the hive and mate on the wing,
mm-hmm.
with many different drones, the male bees, and then returns back to the nest. The queens store a very small percentage of each of her mate's sperm in a small organ known as the spermatheca. And so when she fertilizes the eggs over her 2-3 year lifespan, they're going to have different fathers. And so the colony that she produces, all of her daughter workers then, have different drone fathers, and mm-hmm. so it's a very cosmopolitan population.
Well, I'm sure that's also important to prevent inbreeding and to maintain genetic diversity.
That's exactly, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what we're looking at is, if one male is enough, why does she go to this elaborate mechanism of mating with many? And but there's benefits to that in a honeybee colony. That's a
Indeed.
Honeybee colony.
Sure.
And it seems that what it does is that it seems to prevent, as you said, A, inbreeding, which mm-hmm. is very, very important, and B, sweeping infections. So you can imagine mm-hmm. that if a colony is all comprised of pretty much the same genetic type of
mm-hmm.
bee,
mm-hmm.
and an infection entered the hive that was particularly suited to infect that particular genotype, then everybody in the hive would die off, and the colony itself would collapse. But if it's a cosmopolitan population where there are many different genotypes, then that parasite or pathogen would have to constantly readapt to infect everybody. So the chances that everybody would die due to an infection would be very, very low. So the genetic diversity within the hive seems to be very advantageous and adaptive for honeybees, and that's why they mate so many times.
And I'm sure this is a system that has been perfected by evolutionary trends over, you know, these millions of years.
Yeah, no, I think so. If you look at all the other honeybee species out there, they're also all very polyandrous and exhibit much of these same behaviors.
I see. Well, David, you do a lot of work directly with beekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure both professional and amateur.
Mm-hmm.
What is the life of the beekeeper like these days? Do many people still pursue it as a hobby, a little extra income, maybe selling honey, or has it become too industrialized for the individual these
days?
No.
The majority, 90-95% of the beekeepers out there are hobby beekeepers.
I see.
So they do it. They have 10 or fewer hives, very few number of hives. They do it in their spare time. They do it for the joy and the love of it.
Mm-hmm.
North Carolina, we're incredibly fortunate here to have the largest number of beekeepers per capita than any other state in the nation.
Which makes you a popular guy.
Well, they're certainly a great clientele group to work with. The state association has over 2,000 members. which is one of the larger state associations in the nation. There's 100 counties in this state, and 55 of them have local county chapters of the state organization. Mm-hmm. So if anybody is ever interested in learning how to become a beekeeper or just want to know more about bees, they usually meet once a month. If you go to ncbeekeepers.org, you will find a list of all the different county chapters. If you don't live in a county that has a chapter, you're probably adjacent to one. And it's really, really important to link up with beekeepers so that we can collectively learn about beekeeping and the craft and the different issues that we have to deal with. And it's just really fun and fascinating pastime for a lot of folks.
So what do you do as an extension agent? What are mm-hmm. your duties there?
Well, part of our role in research and extension at NC State is to try and capture the new findings of the scientific community in apiculture and trying to transmit that to the beekeepers themselves. Mm-hmm. So new technologies that come on board, new control methods for varroa mites, mm-hmm. Educating people and beekeepers and the general public about things like CCD or a looming threat, the Africanized honeybees. Mm-hmm. These are all very, very important issues that we try and keep everybody up to date and informed.
So it's similar to the role of any ag extension agent, just Absolutely. In this particular subject area of expertise.
Absolutely. And because honeybees are so central to a lot of different agricultural commodities, it really is an important area.
I see. Well, David, I'm sure everyone is going to want to know, and it would be I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this question. How do you deal with getting stung all the time?
Well, contrary to popular belief, honeybees do not sting very often. They only do so in defense of their hive or if they feel threatened. And so if you see bees flying around foraging on flowers, they're not going to sting you unless you physically try to swat at them or grab them by the tail. Mm-hmm. Entering into a hive, of course, bees are going to naturally want to defend their home, particularly if there's such a rich resource like honey. But beekeepers have been able to deal with honeybee defensive behavior by using smoke.
Right.
It's been known since before recorded time that by applying smoke or at least wafting smoke into a hive, the bees, their natural instinct is to engorge themselves with honey because they think there's a forest fire and therefore they think they need to abandon the hive. So they're much less defensive of their nest in that context. Another thing it also does is it disrupts their communication system, which is primarily done by smell. So if they can't smell their alarm pheromone but rather smoke, then it's more chaos than it is a collective defensive effort.
Mm-hmm.
So by applying smoke and entering into a beehive,
so that keeps from getting swarmed.
Well, that's right. It gets from a lot of bees acting defensively of their nest, of course. But it getting stung once or twice by going through several hives of bees is not uncommon, and is as long as you know how to pull the stinger out of your skin, you're usually not going to get a full dose of venom,
mm-hmm.
And therefore the pain is certainly not as great. Most of the time, when we work our hives, we're just wearing shorts and a t-shirt, and just something to protect the eyes. And the bees really are very passive and not as defensive as most people think. I think the reason that is that a lot of people think that yellow jackets are the same things as honeybees.
Okay.
And, of course, mm-hmm. yellow jackets are a type of wasp.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike honeybees that have a barbed sting, which remains in your skin, and as they pull away, the bees die and the stinger remains in your skin. Wasps have a smooth stinger, so they don't die when they sting you. So they're much more likely to sting you because it's not a kamikaze mission.
Yeah.
So wasps and European hornets, they tend to be a lot more defensive and much more likely to sting because it's not a life or death decision for them. So honeybees, in comparison, are much less likely to sting.
I see. Well, speaking of stings, I heard recently about practices called apitherapy or apipuncture.
Yes.
In which people are stung in controlled ways at acupressure points.
Yes.
Basically a controlled injection of bee venom.
Yes.
Any thoughts about that?
Well, actually, just a few months ago, the national meeting for the Apitherapy Society of America was meeting here in Durham in the Triangle area. It's a very fascinating practice of using bee venom in certain medical applications. One that has been worked out very, very well is bee venom use in arthritis. Other hive products like pollen and propolis.
Does it seem to have anti-inflammatory characteristics?
It does. Seems to. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm the cheap kind, or the poor kind, I like to say. I'm not sure exactly the mechanism, but it has been worked out fairly well as to the medical benefits of bee stings in certain contexts. And so it's definitely an emerging field.
Well, that's going to be something it'll be interesting to keep our eye on.
Yeah.
David, last question for you today, last but not least. What is the one thing about bees that might surprise lay people the most to hear?
What is the one surprising thing? I think one thing that often raises some eyebrows is that most of the bees out there that you see are female. They're not males. So most people refer to bees as he's, and that's incorrect. They should be referred to as she's.
Mm-hmm.
And I should point out that that's true for most bee species. So honeybees are just one of 2,000 or so bee species out there. And so most of the bees you see are she's.
I see. So, well, we want to be sure to get that straight.
Absolutely.
Well, David, I want to thank you very much for sharing your time and expertise today with our Radio In Vivo listening audience. I think we've all caught a buzz.
Excellent.
Give me a little credit. I resisted any puns until the very end of the show. I hope everybody will come out and see you next week, Tuesday night at Tiernanog in Raleigh. For your Science Cafe event.
I'd also like, if I could, put in another plug for National Pollinator Week, which is the last week of June, and there's going to be some workshops being done at the Chatham Marketplace and Weaver Street Marketplace for that event.
I see. Well, that sounds great. So right across the street,
we'll
be doing some pollinating.
Excellent.
Excellent. Thanks, David. Well, we've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. And you can check out the website at radioinvivo.net for the lineup, which is updated regularly as we book new appearances. So we hope you will join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we do ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.